Oh, yeah, I can see the thing's body now. It's large. It's large as a bear. It glistens like wet leather, but that face, ladies and gentlemen, it's indescribable. I can hardly force myself to keep looking at it. It strikes him head on. Lord, they're turning into flames. Now the whole field's caught up by the woods, the bars, the gas tanks of the automobiles spreading everywhere. It's coming this way now, about 20 yards to my right.
It is not a method original with me. It is used by many radio programs. I am terribly shocked by the effect it's had. I do not believe that the method is original with me or peculiar to the Mercury Theater's presentation.
This is Orson Welles, ladies and gentlemen, out of character to assure you that the War of the Worlds has no further significance than as the holiday offering it was intended to be. The Mercury Theater's own radio version of dressing up in a sheet and jumping out of a bush and saying boo.
It's the radio show that keeps on giving. From October 30th, 1938, over CBS radio network stations, a live production of an adaptation of a novel written 40 years earlier, performed by the players and technicians of a struggling radio theater company only a few months old and relatively obscure, even though it has the biggest star in radio as its driving force, visionary, and lead actor. What the Mercury Theater Company was able to do with War of the Worlds is remarkable. But the effect it had on listeners has been exaggerated, and still is, by a hostile print media and perpetuated by teachers and professors misled by lazy newspaper reporting and the questionable research of the Radio Research Office at the Princeton Radio Project. I'm Paul Cross. This is Cross Talk, Media History, Commentary, and Analysis. Season 3, Episode 5. I established in Season 1, Episodes 7 and 8, that War of the Worlds did not cause widespread mass panic. Researcher Hadley Cantrill, who gets his name front and center on the Radio Project research into listener reactions, misinterpreted some data, overstated some, and used pretty vague and liberal interpretations to conclude that some listeners were, quote, excited by what they thought they were hearing. I won't go much deeper on those points in this episode. There's plenty more to talk about. You might wish to go back and listen to those two episodes from Season 1. As I point out there, Cantrill, in the introduction to his original report in 1940 and in revisiting the work in 1966, writes that thousands of people panicked. That's a far cry from what print and academia have misled us to believe. There is a great deal of sloppy, sensationalized reporting in newspapers, which were still frightened at radio's ability to report news as it was happening, and their owners were angry about the flow of advertising dollars to radio. It is disingenuous to suggest that War of the Worlds was fake news or that Orson Welles intended to mislead people. Academics who suggest so are either misinformed or biased against radio or intellectually dishonest, in my view. We know from Cantrill's report, Invasion from Mars, and I think researcher Hazel Godet wanted him to look more carefully at this, that people who tuned in late were more likely to think they were hearing something that was really happening. Godet worried Cantrill had decided in advance that there was panic. And what some interviewees told her was that they thought the invasion was by a foreign army, not by Martians. How could that be so? I think we need to explore more about what was happening in the world at the time of the broadcast. So let's go back in time. It's 1938, October 30th, Halloween time, a time for scary stories, but recent world events have people on edge across Europe and throughout North America. How close is the world to a major war? In September, it's radio, including CBS, the network that a month later will broadcast War of the Worlds, that is bringing live reports from Europe into millions of homes. British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain goes to Munich to meet German Chancellor Adolf Hitler over his threats to take over Sudetenland, part of Czechoslovakia since the end of the First World War. Chamberlain agrees to let Hitler take it if he promises not to invade the rest of Czechoslovakia. On September 23rd, CBS is live. Listen to Bob Trout of CBS Radio News setting up here to H.V. Kaltenborn and the CBS reporter in London, Edward R. Murrow.
Prime Minister returns to England Saturday morning, and that is the end of the communique. Now, in the studio with me here is Columbia's news analyst, Mr. H.V. Kaltenborn, who is going to call England direct and find out what London is thinking about. For in our London studios are Edward R. Murrow, Columbia's chief European correspondent, waiting to hold a conversation at this end with Mr. Kaltenborn. And now here is Mr. Kaltenborn.
Hello, Ed Murrow. Are you there? Hello, Ed. Calling London.
Good evening, Hans.
Good evening, Ed. Are you prepared to answer a few questions that I should like to put to you?
I'll try.
Here is the situation as we see it. Bob Trout has just read the last press radio bulletin, which gives the communique issued by both Hitler and Chamberlain.
Days later, German forces move into Czechoslovakia, and the news comes back over the radio. Archived audio from specific dates on specific networks or radio stations is not always to be found, but listen to how reporter Ralph Murray speaks as he broadcasts to Britain on the BBC from inside the occupied city of Prague on October 4th.
I'm speaking from Prague. I'm sorry if there was perhaps a hitch a moment ago about coming over to me here, but considering the difficulties and trials through which the administration is going at the moment, I think it's rather a wonder that there is a line through at all. I have been out in the zones being occupied through the Czech troops moving back as they evacuate bit after bit of Bohemia.
Through the growing crisis, radio increases the frequency of its news bulletins. By late October, according to researcher A. Brad Schwartz, CBS Radio is broadcasting a new bulletin almost every hour. So listeners were accustomed to hearing news bulletins on the radio, and they expected radio to inform them. In Toronto, War of the Worlds was broadcast over CFRB, the radio station known today as News Talk 1010. If the broadcast caused mass panic, one might think there would be some evidence of it here. And had that happened, one might think the newspapers of the day might have documented it in their pages. So far, I have not found any archived audio from radio stations of the time to compare how they reported on the fallout from the show, if they did at all. But I can dig back through the newspaper archives at the Toronto Reference Library on Yonge Street or online, and what's there is quite revealing. I think in the future I need to try to conduct a content analysis of stories from the various Toronto newspapers of the time, including the Star, the Globe, and the Telegram. For this episode, War of the Worlds appears in the radio program listings in the Toronto Daily Star for Sunday, October 30th, 1938. Between October 31st, the day after the show, and November 2nd, there are at least 8 articles about War of the Worlds published in the Star. Only 3 appear to point out the fact that the show was available locally over CFRB. The front page of the Star, the day after the broadcast, screams out, "Ottawa seeks way to ban radio horrors," all in uppercase. Anger flares as U.S. public gets over radio panic. Thriller curb likely. Hysteria sweeps country as Martian invasion graphically described. Probe is started. Senator has bill ready to prevent scaring of children and adults. And then the story finally begins, with the Star asking the CBC, which also acted as the broadcast regulator in Canada at that time, for input on taking action against this type of radio, even before it reports the name of the local radio station that aired it. None of the articles I can find in the Star between October 31st and November 2nd quotes anyone from CFRB, nor is there any indication the newspaper attempted to get any comment or input from the only Toronto radio station that carried the broadcast, not even in the article by a reporter by the name of Gordon Sinclair. Sinclair's story takes pains to include comments from various police representatives, city council members, school principals, church leaders, but nothing from anyone inside CFRB. That seems like a pretty serious oversight. I think it's a deliberate exclusion. Sinclair, by the way, started broadcasting on CFRB in 1942 and was associated with the radio station for the next 40 years. Finally, back to Wells's point that this is not a format original to him. that broadcasting radio drama as if the actor speaking was a newsperson had been done before. In 1926, a broadcast on the BBC out of Edinburgh caused some listeners to think London had been attacked and that the famous Savoy Hotel was blown up. Broadcasting the barricades was introduced as a skit about radio, but the parody of news reporting was done so realistically, some listeners believed it. Once again, mostly those who tuned in late and missed the introduction. But fictional portrayals of events as if they were actually happening were nothing new in America either, certainly not at CBS. The Fall of the City by Archibald MacLeish was written specifically to be performed by Orson Welles. It aired on CBS April 11th, 1937.
Here in this city, the wall of the time cracks. We take you now to the great square of this city. We are here on the central plaza. We are well off to the eastward edge. There's a kind of terrace over the crowd here. It is precisely 4:40. The crowd is enormous. There might be 10,000. There might be more. The whole square is faces. Opposite, over the roofs of the mountains. It is quite clear. There are birds circling. We think they are kites by the look. They're very high. The tomb is off to the right somewhere. We can't see for the great crowd. Close to us here are the cabinet ministers. They stand on a raised platform with awnings. The farmers' wives are squatting on the stones.
There was no panic then, and no cries to curb radio or radio news. In fact, CBS was so pleased, it hired MacLeish to write another show in a similar style. It was broadcast both October 27th and 28th, 1938, just before War of the Worlds 2 days later on the 30th. And it has a frightening title for the times I've been describing, Air Raid. I think 1938 brought a perfect storm against radio. The worldwide anxiety over Germany's aggression in Europe. Radio's increasing frequency of reports live from overseas. Radio continuing to scoop the newspapers on this major story of the times, which would appear in the newspaper later or not until the next day. Print anger over the superior breaking news ability of radio. The public's reliance upon and trust in radio news. Hostile articles in newspapers, and Cantrill's earnest but misguided approach to investigate what he preconceived as the panic. You might wish to read Cantrill, The Invasion from Mars, A Study in the Psychology of Panic from 1940. And for some really extensive new research into the background of the broadcast and letters to Welles and CBS, see Broadcast Hysteria, Orson Welles' War of the Worlds and the Art of Fake News by A. Brad Schwartz from 2015. War of the Worlds is celebrated now every October 30th on World Audio Drama Day. I expect I'll continue to have more to say about it each time. This is Crosstalk. I'm Paul Cross. I study and I teach podcasting and radio.